Yeah. I will. I'll move the microphone very, very closely. The simple answer is nothing at all, but in fact it goes even further than that. Under the 1984 Convention Against Torture, you don't even need to show a nexus of nationality. Any person who is alleged to have tortured any other person anywhere in the world who finds himself or herself in the United Kingdom is at risk of investigation or prosecution. I'm interested in your question. I've been asked it by others. A few months back, I interviewed President Carter in a rather public forum at the Hay Literary Festival in Wales. And you can see the conversation or the bit of it that's relevant to this on YouTube. It was posted on YouTube. You just type in President Carter Hay Festival. And you'll see that I asked him, in a sense, precisely the same question. I noted he raised the question of Pinochet. He has also been very strong on torture. And I put it to him that the consequences of his own writings, his own positions, and the no impunity argument had certain logical consequences for his own current president. And he was very agile in his response, and he paused, and he then said with great deliberation, in response to my question, what future do you expect for President Bush? He said, well, I hope that my president is able to live in secure retirement in his own country. And he was, I think, understood by the audience to be signalling that certain people will not be travelling abroad after this administration sees the end of its days. And it's quite clear to me from the reaction of certain people who've testified before Congress in the hearings that have happened that there is very palpable and real concern about risk of foreign investigation and the implications that has for foreign travel. So this is not hypothetical or theoretical. I'm not saying it will happen. I'm not necessarily saying it should happen. But it is there in the ether, and it is a very real issue. No, that's not the way the conventions work. The person has to be located on the territory. There's no power to seek extradition of a third person. There has to be some nexus in the sense that the person has to be physically located on the territory of the state. But bear in mind, there are 150 states that are parties to the Torture Convention, and if person X were to go to the United Kingdom, any one of the other 149 states are then entitled to make a request for extradition. Now, that, of course, applies equally to the United States in the sense that these people are located in the United States. The United States is a party to those conventions, to that convention. But I see no prospect of the United States extraditing one of its own to any third country for jurisdiction. So I don't think that's a likely prospect.
Can I, before I turn the microphone over to you, there's something that's been mentioned here several times, and I want to just comment very briefly on it. I am not as sure as some of my colleagues here that the 2006 immunity provision isn't just chock full of holes. For example, it only applies to aliens. Well, they tortured some American citizens too, you know. Mm-hmm. And it only applies to aliens who were awaiting an opinion on whether they are enemy noncombatants or have been adjudged enemy noncombatants. I suspect a lot of aliens have now been released. They're no longer awaiting assessment of whether they're an enemy combatant, and they were never judged an enemy combatant. So, and it cuts two ways. I'm not going to get into that. But if the immunity provision is full of holes, it can cut either of two ways. But I'll let that one go for the moment. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, can I comment on the
yeah, sure.
I'm not a fan of universal jurisdiction. And just give an example of the unfortunate symmetry that can occur in these situations is that a variation of that principle is what the U.S. used to put people like David Hicks in Guantanamo, which is any crime anywhere in the world is within our jurisdiction in that context, even though 99% of all the people who have ever been at Gitmo in detention never engaged United States forces. So you have to be careful what you wish for in that regard, because I think that it becomes a very, very political process in terms of who gets charged where and retaliation and reciprocity and all of that. In the same vein, it may impede the ability of forces within the United States, such as people here in this room and any other people who are in agreement with us, that something has to be done, regardless of the form it takes, because there will be nothing to – the circling of the wagons that will occur across all lines if a United States president or a United States secretary – a vice president or secretary of defense is hailed into a foreign court to answer for questions about United States policy. That is not something I don't think that any sitting government will tolerate, and it will just impede the notion. In other words, to find out what happened and to get at some process of going forward in a manner that doesn't repeat what happened, if you then are starting to open up people to foreign prosecution, there will be resistance to finding out anything here in the United States. So that's just a caveat in terms of looking to foreign prosecution as somehow an answer before we really resolve it here in the United States as to what we're going to do.
My name is Yolanta Kormanitska. I'm a PhD student at Boston University studying medieval torture. So I have a particular perspective on what's going on. However, my question is for the entire panel, and I was wondering, in terms of when you're speaking about the various committees that could be convened within the House and the Senate and things of that nature, how do you deal with the fact that we right now have members of the current or former members of the current administration who are ignoring subpoenas? How do you actually get them to show up? And is this something that you're referring to in terms of going after the small fish first, offering them the plea bargains, and therefore hopefully being able to go after some of the larger fish? How do we actually deal with those problems?
Would anybody particularly relish? Go ahead, Chris.
I'll say a little bit. I've worked for two congressional investigations in the Watergate era. The first one investigated military spying on civilian politics, something I had the pleasure of disclosing as a former intelligence officer. And the second one was working for Senator Church's Select Committee on Intelligence. The general principle is you don't find out much from the high mucky mutts. They have a disease that General Taguba called CRS. Can't remember shit. And they will come in for the afternoon. You can subpoena them. You can even give them immunity, and they can't remember shit. So you're not going to get much from them. But if you remember in the Watergate hearing, they brought in a guy named Butterfield, and they asked him some questions and found out that there actually was a taping system in the Oval Office. That's where you find shit. And yes, you're going to, I alluded to all the obstacles you run into in conducting these investigations. And that's why I like congressional investigations if they're well run, and the two I was part of were very well run, because they know how to get around things. I mean, on the Army surveillance investigation that we did, I just went out and interviewed 125 former intelligence agents. Talk to the guys who'd done the spying. We didn't need the Defense Department, which, of course, was lying. They had a 50-man unit in the Pentagon whose sole job was to try to discredit what I had disclosed. And they worked for a year and a half at it. Were unsuccessful. Your taxpayers' money. Well, that's what the kind of obstacles you face in this business. The damage control units on the other side who are going to be working assiduously to deny you the information. But Joe Darby's pictures got out, right? And when you get someone who goes out there and says, I'm from the Congress and I've got a couple of questions to ask you, that gives you some cachet. It can help at the low levels.
You know, Chris, it was you against 50. I think you had pretty good odds. Did you want to say something, Josh?
I just said the contempt power is authentic in the sense that with fines and imprisonment for those who defy subpoenas, it exists and it's effective. No one wants – the economic part of it actually is very effective as probably even more so than imprisonment, because imprisonment would expire with the expiration of the investigation itself. So if you can torpedo an investigation and you can just ride it out, but if you're getting fined $5,000 a day, which we've seen in the criminal courts, even more sometimes for obstruction, essentially by failing to honor subpoenas, it's an effective mechanism.
Sir.
My name is Kevin McCarron. I served 6 years active duty in the Marine Corps. My question is this. It seems to me that Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi and Congressman John Conyers, in suppressing the constitutional remedy of impeachment, have aided and abetted the criminality of the Bush maladministration. So my question is, are there no grounds for impeaching these two members of Congress as well?
Impeachment is a process by which the legislature removes an executive or a judge. It is not a process by which the legislature removes one of its own. And so that's not possible. I think you need to cut Pelosi a bit of slack because...
Yeah.
Want to hear the because? She didn't have the votes. In order to impeach anybody, you need 2/3 vote of the Senate to remove them from office. And it was quite clear that they would never get 2/3 of the Senate. In fact, it was not clear, because of the number of Blue Dog Democrats, that they would get a majority of the House to approve articles of impeachment. That was a political reality that Pelosi had to deal with. Now, there may have been other steps that she could have taken that would have made us all feel a little better about that. But the fact is, impeachment requires bipartisan support, given the spread between the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress today. And we didn't have it.
Chris, what is your opinion, on the question which has been raised extensively on the Internet? I read a lot of Internet stuff that's pulled down for in a hard copy because I don't even know how to turn on a computer. I write blogs. I mean, it's amazing. I don't even know how to turn on a computer. But what is your opinion of the idea that has been bruited about that one of the reasons there's been so little action in Congress is Democrat complicity in the torture?
Members of Congress are sent to Washington by you and me to get goodies for our district. They get contracts for corporations in our districts. They get grants for communities in our districts. That puts them in the relationship of supplicant to the president, no matter whether the president is of their party or the other party. And when you are in a position of a supplicant, you do not exercise congressional oversight as rigorously as you might. There was a reason. That's a sufficient answer. We should be keeping them short. And I wish it were otherwise, but Congress is a flawed institution. And part of it is because Congress has given the executive the power to dispense enormous amounts of money through decisions of sub-cabinet officials, whether it's in forestry or in environment or anything else. And that leads members of Congress not to be as assiduous as they might in oversight.
I think as someone who was directly involved at the time of the both the Military Commission Detainee Treatment Act and Military Commission Act in terms of representing people at Guantanamo, there was extraordinary Democratic complicity at a time when any backbone would have been effective in many ways in moderating that legislation, if not eliminating it altogether. But in the context of the first question that was asked, that's the type of wide net that I wish we would not be looking at. I wish we would concentrate on the people who've committed crimes deliberately against other persons, not people who made policy choices based on a wide variety of considerations which we may agree or not agree with. But the wider we cast this net, the less likely we are to punish those who are really responsible and who create mechanisms that prevent it in the future.
Dean Noble,
yes, ma'am.
I
don't believe you were standing there, ma'am.
Two over here, too, as well as over there.
All right, well, I thought that, why don't we have you go next, young lady?
Yes, hi. My name's Elaine Brower. I'm on the National Steering Committee for World Can't Wait, and I'm also a member of Military Families Speak Out. My son is currently on his third tour of duty in Iraq. We talked about accountability to deter. We talked about dissuading the president. We talked about restoring the rule of law. And all of this is in general context based on our Congress and our democratic system. And we talked about possibly having another commission formed, a truth commission of some sort, which would probably employ more of the same people that we are seeing at the top of the government, whether they be representatives or senators or even people that are somewhat affiliated with the corporate environment or the either party system. My question is, how do we have a Truth and Reconciliation Committee that is not only encompassing those types of academics, lawyers, people that are involved with the government, but the people like us? How do we empower and have the resources to get people that are in this movement who really want to get to the bottom of this to work along in a Truth and Reconciliation Committee in this country and not have it go abroad, because it won't happen if we wait till it goes abroad?
I'm not going to try to answer your question because I don't know the answer, but I am extraordinarily sympathetic to what you've said. All one has to do is read Jellicoe's book about the 9/11 Commission, and you cannot help but be sympathetic to what this lady has said. Now, what does anybody here want to respond to what you said?
There obviously aren't hard and fast answers to that question. However, if I were to try to provide a framework for it, one is, again, very narrow focus. If you terrify every government official that they're going to go to jail, you'll never have a commission. You'll never have any inquiry whatsoever.
What if they all should go to jail?
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because you don't know that they all should go to jail. I will tell you that sounds to me like what I heard about the 700 people at Guantanamo. That they're all terrorists, they're all guilty. I'm saying that there has to be the perfect is the enemy of the good here. It just is. And I don't have any faith in Congress, to answer that woman's question. I have no faith in Congress, okay? I would take it outside of Congress, but give it the authority of a congressional investigation, but take it outside of Congress. And obviously, you know, we can't do this in advance, but obviously I would prefer not to staff it with political retreads and appointments that way, but to a certain extent, to have some authority, it's going to have to. So there has to be some merger there. But as Chris knows better than anyone here, is that a motivated staff of investigative attorneys and other professionals is an extraordinary weapon in the search for truth. And that, to me, is the most important thing that you can have in these in any commission. And I know that everybody thinks that jail is the great motivator for truth, but I can tell you that it is not. And it just may be, I'm not saying it is, but it just may be for 95% of these people who we want to interview and find out what happened, that telling them they won't go to jail may get the truth from them more than jail. I've been in situations in investigations with unions and other organizations where the prospect of penalty shuts people down, and the prospect of amnesty gets people to come forward. Now, it's not a categorical answer either way, but it's a nuanced answer that has to be carefully treaded.
I don't know. Is Vince Bugliosi here yet? Vince, are you here? Well, you know, Vince will tell you, I'm sure, just to give you the other side of it, that something that everybody knows anyway, There is nothing like the threat of jail to have the, to cause the underlings to open up and tell you the truth that puts the overlords in the slammer. So that's just the other side of what Josh is talking about. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. My name is Susan Harmon. I'm an activist, and I'm delighted to see other activists here. I work with Code Pink, the National Impeachment Network. Yes. And Progressive Democrats of America for a while. There are three things that I'm lying awake at night about. Harriet Myers, the postponement of her testimony. She was due to testify in front of the Judiciary Committee on Thursday. That's in an appeals court. We're crossing our fingers and waiting. So I'd like a comment about that. I wonder if Dershowitz's op-ed piece...
Go ahead. Get it.
Okay. I wonder if Dershowitz's piece in the Wall Street Journal means anything good. But most of all, I'm concerned about pardons. And as I understand it, if we don't impeach immediately, which means in the next 2 weeks before they go home on the 26th, they can pardon everyone. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card. And that's what I really lie awake at night about. You mentioned pardons, but you went by it really quickly. And I think it's not being talked about anywhere near enough. And I'd love some expert opinion on how to prevent that.
Well, go ahead. Who wants to answer that?
I'm not an expert on pardons. I can't talk about that. But I will address that part of your question that concerns Professor Dershowitz's op-ed, which appeared in yesterday's Wall Street Journal and is a passionate plea on his behalf that there be no criminal investigations of any former administration officials. I think I can say something about the context of that. Op-ed. I am in debate with Professor Dershowitz on Tuesday afternoon at Harvard Law School in a public event. I think if you go on the Harvard Law School website, you will be able to find it. I believe it's also going to be webcast. He and I have debated several times before. We haven't debated on the issue of criminal investigations. We have debated on the utility of torture. I believe he is essentially an enabler because he has argued passionately for the institutionalization of torture in the sense that his argument, as I understand it, is that if torture is going to happen, and he says it shouldn't happen, but if it is going to happen, let's get it accountable, let's get it transparent, let's get it signed off by judges. That is a terrible argument because it opens the door to abuse. I mean, it's absolutely clear. And the British experience, which of course has affected my generation greatly, because we moved to abuse in the 1970s against the IRA, and we learnt it doesn't produce meaningful information, it undermines the morale of those who have to be engaged in the abusive activity, it most significantly creates the best possible recruiting tool for those who challenge us, and that is precisely what has happened here. And I suspect that his op-ed piece is a sort of preemptive shot before our debate on Tuesday afternoon.
You know, I would add something. I'm going to write a blog.
5 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon.
I am going to write a blog about blog posting, but one thing that leaps out of that article at you is that never does he mention the word torture. Never does he mention the phrases aggressive war or preemptive war. It's entirely an abstract essay, very much the same criticism leveled at John Yoo's first memo of August 1. The first memo has nothing to do with anything concrete. Good lawyers don't do that.
Larry, can I just sound a positive note? I mean, inspired as we are, all of us, to a man and woman in Britain by Monty Python. Always, always look on the bright side of life, okay? And the fact is that when people like Alan Dershowitz and the Wall Street Journal are writing editorials and the New York Times are running op-eds on the issue of criminal investigation or prosecution,
It suggests that the subject has finally made its way onto the radar screen. Serious people are writing about it, and I see it as a very positive development that these types of articles are appearing.
I agree with that.
I don't think it's going to happen.
We're going here.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Dr. Ilya Perlin.
Look, there can't be impeachment within the next week, and I'm not even sure that the logic of what you were saying is correct. So given the time constraints which we are working under, you know, forgive me, but I'm going to go on to the next.
Time constraints are 2 weeks of Congress, this session of Congress. That means impeachment is now. Why not?
All right, folks, I am now going to recognize the next questioner.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Dr. Ilya Perlin-Jerry. I'm the author of several books. I'm not an attorney. My last book was on women's health and environmental issues. I'm a retired professor. And I chaired the state of Maine's first climate change conference in the state 2 years ago. Last year, I was invited, one of 40 Americans, to address Congress on climate change issues. And I can tell you from talking to many senators and congresspeople that my personal take is that the system is broken, that it's Congress is accountable no longer to we the people, but to we the corporations, and there are no answers. I'm also, tragically, the survivor of a 1 million-acre firestorm in Southern California, and I can tell you in terms of accountability, there is no accountability, not in the last 8 years. The president came in late, and he said there would be help, and there was no help. There was $9.4 million that came into San Diego County and up to Los Angeles County. It never went to help anybody who needed help, not for anything but for hiring people to count dead bodies and destroyed buildings. And we were all left to our own devices, even those of us who had no insurance. FEMA wanted money back for people that they had given with interest, no less. So accountability is not there. What do you do when there is no accountability and the system is broken? The checks and balances that we used to have are not there anymore. I agree. I agree.
Does anybody here want to comment on that? Okay. I will only say that I think that ties in some important ways with the point made by the young woman whose son is on his third tour. And so presumably this will get discussed tomorrow at the noon hour, I guess, or just after the noon hour. Yes, ma'am.
Can I say just a little bit about
Sure.
I agree with you. I teach American politics. I've studied these things, and I've worked in Congress. But it's not totally broken. There are remnants of it. And it is going to take some wit and imagination and cleverness and moderation on our parts and subtlety on our parts to make pieces of it work. And we will not be totally successful any more than we were in the era called Watergate. But it's the only game we've got, because the next step has to be revolution.
Yes.
If you're, and frankly, I don't think revolution is a starter. I think it gets worse if you get that frustrated and that angry. You do not have that as an option in this country today. You've got to find some way to appeal to the better angels of our nature. And that's not going to be easy. And it's going to require a lot of us speaking out, but speaking out with moderation. Impeachment's not possible. I'm sorry. I would have loved it. But it's not possible. Politically, it is not possible. You can't do anything in 2 weeks in Congress. Let me tell you, I've been there.
All right. The next young lady there.
Thank you. My name is Nancy White. I'm from Amherst, New Hampshire, and I'm here representing the Northeast Impeachment Coalition, Code Pink, PDA, After Downing Street, whatever else you want to say. I'm also a citizen of New Hampshire. And I want to inform the panel that we have a state representative, Betty Hall, who will be here later today. And she has introduced into the state legislature for 2 years now a resolution called H.R. 24. Now, the New Hampshire State Legislature is a member of 400 people body. It's a state representative citizen representation. 400 people. It's the third largest constitutional representational body in the world besides the U.S. Congress and Parliament. And we have brought up H.R. 24 three times, and the fourth time is coming up September 24th, 2 days before the Congress of the U.S. adjourns. Now, in our state, we have the right of revolution. It's Article 10. We also have the act of conscience, which is an inalienable act in our Constitution, as well as the right of assembly, instruction, and petition. And I have in my hand two resolutions that were passed this May at the New Hampshire Democratic Party. One that calls for...
Can I ask you what the ultimate point of this is, because it's getting
what,
on?
What I'm saying to you is, here is a state legislature ready to vote on the 24th of September with H.R. 24. And the resolution states we have the right to begin an investigation in the U.S. Congress brought forth by a state legislature, which, Chris, you just talked about. And here it is.
Okay,
we need your support.
We got it. Chris, you want to comment on that?
I'm on the board of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And we have managed to get 350, 400 of those resolutions from various communities around the country. And I've forgotten now, it's 5 to 8 states as well. And these are important political activities. Don't underestimate that. Things move in this country if there's strong grassroots support. And it's by what you're doing that we do begin to build support and get members of Congress to move in a new direction. And so I commend you for that. But I also have to tell you, as a political reality, that the Congress moves in a glacial pace. And it moves because there are particular personal ambitions of members of Congress who head committees to do certain things. So that is just one piece of the effort. And I think you should go ahead with that. I really do, and I honor you for doing that. But this is going to be a highly complicated effort that's going to have to proceed in the press, in Congress, in the courts. And there are a lot of impediments that we're going to have to be clever about to get around, such as the subpoena issue. That is a serious issue. The subpoena and the refusal of the executive privilege question, the pardon question. And many of these questions we have not resolved legally in this country, but we've got to do it. And this is not a bad context in which to resolve those questions. But we are dealing with a judiciary that is been a probably 50 to 60% of the members of the federal court system right now have been appointed by Reagan or Bush, or one of the Bushes.
Right,
and
listen,
it's going to be hard.
This folks, simply says to bring
Ma'am, I'm sorry. I've got to turn your microphone over to somebody else.
Yeah, and that's important. You should do that. Thank you.
Now, there are four people left.
Yeah, there are four.
Well, I know. You materialized from somewhere.
No. She's been up there. She's been there since the beginning.
Okay. There are four people left. Isn't there another young lady behind? Okay, there are three people left.
Okay.
There's three people. That's going to be it, folks.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
we can hear you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Cantaro. I hadn't
planned to speak this morning. I'm afraid I came late. I'm an activist. I live in Medford, Massachusetts. My arena of activity for the past 30 years or so has been Israel and Palestine, perhaps a topic not popular among some people and perhaps a topic popular among other people. I've, of course, read Alan Dershowitz extensively in that bailiwick and know very well his I'm not surprised that you said what you did about Professor Dershowitz. Let me say what I have been particularly concerned about as an American citizen since the Bush administration took since the Bush regime came to power. One, I'm concerned that finally Americans have been living in a full-fledged imperium under neo-fascism, which means rule by the corporations and the military with a...
I'm going to rule that out of order. I understand how you feel. A lot of us might agree with you.
Sorry.
But that's not the
Let
subject
me bypass
of this
that,
panel.
Then. I would say that we live in very difficult times. I've lived a fairly long life, like many people in this room, and this is the most frightening time of my lifetime, save for the Cuban Missile Crisis. We are surrounding Russia with NATO bases. We are angling for war with Russia. China is shaking hands with Iran. There have been many threats by the United States and Israel against Iran. We face the possibility of nuclear holocaust, and we certainly face the probability of we're in global warming and we might have a meltdown.
I'm going to ask
planet.
You to give up the microphone to the next person who might want to ask a question, because much as I sympathize with what you're saying, that is not the subject of this panel. Why don't you go ahead, ma'am?
Philippe, this is just for you. I need to clarify something about Cat 3. With Cat 3, when U.S. Code 18, Section 2441, when he wrote a presidential directive released 20 July 2007 to kind of say, oh, sorry, I'm the president. I know better than Geneva, and everything's copacetic, and I say what's right. Torture, pizza. We didn't do anything wrong. So were you saying that internationally that doesn't count then? Is that?
It's totally irrelevant.
Right, good,
it's
good.
It's irrelevant
okay.
in the same way good. That the president of Iran or the parliament of Israel or the president of Syria or any other United Kingdom or France adopts a unilateral interpretation of the Geneva Conventions, it cannot bind the rest of the world. So it's, they're living in cloud cuckoo land if they think they can pass legislation which is going to resonate in the rest of the world. It won't, it hasn't, it cannot.
And it has as much domestic relevance as if he said the First Amendment doesn't apply.
Right, right. And I just wanted to ask also, CCR Justice, they said that they had gotten, again, that their appeal was... accepted in Germany for torture and France for torture, Germany for war crimes. Anybody know? Heard anything about
that? Well, I think Peter Weiss is here and he knows far better than but there was an effort by the Center for Constitutional Rights and a German partner to bring proceedings or to assist in the bringing of proceedings against Donald Rumsfeld and I think several others. That has not progressed as far as I know because the prosecutor has... found reasons for suggesting that there was not a basis at that time for going forward. But I think, it's not the end of the story, and for the present purposes, that's the situation.
Sorry, take your time. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Valeria Giorgio. I'm an attorney. I'm a workers' rights attorney. I work for a nonprofit, and I've been involved in the struggle for global justice since Seattle. I was in Seattle during the World Trade Organization 1999. Shut down. And as you know, 9/11 completely quashed that. It may have been strategized. I wanted to reiterate the woman before me. She had a good question, and it came to my mind as well. What is the process to come up with a strategy? And I believe this is not just a question-making session, but a comment-making session to have a participatory dialogue where we as a people can come together to prioritize how we will prosecute the administration. So having reiterated that, I will now move to my own point, which is we as a people have to self-determine our sense of justice here. I think foreign reliance is a good idea if we cannot do that ourselves, but is there a possibility for a multiplicitous approach? Those from other nations who have their own sense of justice based on their citizens' victimization can well proceed. But as a people, we have to restore our own name for our own sake. As Professor Velvel had said earlier, I think he was quoting someone, I'm not sure, it is about us now and our own sense of dignity. So can we have some sort of multiplicitous, multinational approach at prosecution and not just rely on other nations?
I'm not the right person to comment on what you can do domestically, but absolutely this goes forward in a what you call a multiplicitous way. What we've learned in other contexts, take the example of Chile, and to take the question about who sits on a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's a very important question. There's an awful lot of experience around the world of where it works and where it doesn't work. In Chile, it didn't work, and the reason that it didn't work in many people's minds is that it had the wrong people on it. In South Africa, it worked. But in Chile, they had a series of domestic initiatives, but it was only when the international efforts, not just of Spain, but also of Sweden, of Belgium, of Switzerland, and of France, to have prosecutors investigate Senator Pinochet, did that cause a change of consciousness domestically in Chile, such that Chile itself struck out the amnesty, struck out its immunities, and began to look seriously after 1998 at what had happened. And I hope I've been very clear. I've expressed the view, and I express it again. It's first and foremost for the United States to sort out its situation. But if the United States doesn't sort out its own situation, others will contribute to doing it on its behalf.
You've been listening to a panel from the Justice Robert Jackson Conference on the Planning for the Prosecution of High-Level American War Criminals that took place in Andover, Massachusetts in September 2008. We'll conclude the show with the next installment of Power and Powerlessness, a book by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. Rosenthal, an MD and psychotherapist, has concluded that social equality is necessary for human health. In this, the final section of the book, she addresses how to bring about that social equality and break down the powerlessness experienced by most people in capitalist society by dismantling the power of a small ruling class. Last week, I began reading from Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On. Last week, she began by focusing on the importance of class in American society and putting forward a social definition of class. A social-based definition of class would measure two variables, she said, the control that people have over their work and the control that they have over other people's work. Using these criteria, we can divide modern society into three classes: the class that rules, the capitalist class, the class that obeys, the working class, and the class in between, the middle class. In today's reading, we begin as she fleshes out her definitions of the classes. The class that rules. The capitalist class, also called the ruling class, has the most power because it owns or controls the natural resources required to create wealth. The labor process of creating wealth and the wealth that is created sees the surplus. Because it controls all of these things, a capitalist class decides the overall direction of society, determining what will be produced, how it will be produced, and who will have access to the resulting goods and services. The values of the capitalist class also dominate society. This class has the power to launch a war and to pay for that war by gutting social programs. People in the capitalist class include the CEOs of the largest corporations, the presidents and directors of the largest universities and banks, and the highest-ranking politicians, government bureaucrats, judges, and military officers. Each nation has its own capitalist class, and together they form a global capitalist class. Capitalists are in constant competition for capital. Larger corporations swallow up smaller ones and grow larger. Stronger nations dominate weaker ones and grow stronger. Ceaseless competition has caused the ruling class to shrink in size while it grows in wealth and power. By 2005, 1% of people at the top of society owned one-third of America's financial wealth. The class that obeys. The capitalist class controls the means of production. The working class sets it in motion. Although it creates all the wealth in society, the working class has the least power. People in the working class own no land, no factories, no machines, no businesses, nor any other means of making a living. They can, of course, own personal property, such as home and vehicle. Workers can survive only by selling their ability to labor in exchange for a wage. They have no control over how they produce and what they produce. They have no control over the labor of others. Some people argue that workers can buy into capitalism by purchasing company stocks. In fact, most stocks and bonds are owned by the top 10% of the population. Furthermore, owning shares does not give people the power to control corporate decisions. Employees who owned shares in United Airlines were powerless to stop the restructuring that cost them their jobs, benefits, and pensions. While the ruling class has shrunk over time, the working class has grown in size. More than half the global population is urban working class, with the next largest group being small farmers who are middle class because they own a little land. In the United States, about 80% of the population is working class, the vast majority. The working class includes clerks, receptionists, bookkeepers, cleaners, janitors, cashiers, paramedics, miners, telephone operators, service technicians, mechanics, bank tellers, and also factory, farm, retail, restaurant, hotel, construction, and transport workers. Over the past 50 years, the composition of the working class has changed. Rising productivity has made it possible to accumulate more surplus from fewer workers. Some of this surplus was used to expand the service sector, finance, transportation, hotels, restaurants, and the education, medical, and penal systems. This shift in capital caused the proportion of industrial workers to fall and the proportion of service workers to rise. Both industrial and service workers are working class. Neither group controls the condition of its own work or the work of others. Workers' efforts to exert some control over their work through unions will be discussed later on. The class in the middle. The middle class is the second largest social class. Forming about 20% of the North American population, the middle class sits between the two other classes, blending into the capitalist class at one end and the working class at the other end. People in the middle class have an intermediate level of power, having some control over their own work and some control over the work of others. The middle class owns or controls some means of production. The small farmer owns some land. The self-employed artisan owns some tools. The corner store retailer buys and sells produce. Sections of the middle class employ and exploit workers on a small scale. The 18th century middle class was composed primarily of small farmers and fishermen, artisans, entertainers, lower-level clergy, traders, and owners of small businesses. As capitalism developed, it concentrated capital in fewer hands, obliterating much of the traditional middle class. This process continues today. Giant agricultural corporations' agribusiness swallow family farms, forcing people off their land and into the cities. Fast food chains replace family restaurants. Factories flood the market with cheap, mass-produced goods, pushing skilled craftspeople to the fringe of the economy. With no family business to inherit, children of the traditional middle class have gone to work for the same corporations that put their parents out of business. Some become middle-class managers and professionals. Modern industry has expanded the role of the salaried professional. The owner of a small factory can personally direct every worker. In large industries, many supervisors are needed to oversee the work of hundreds or thousands of workers. Supervision is needed because bosses and workers have opposite goals. Bosses want workers to produce as much as possible to boost profits. Workers want to slow down to preserve their health. Bosses want to lower wages to cut costs. Workers want higher wages so they can pay their bills. Because the capitalist can stay in business only by forcing the worker to produce more and to surrender more of the value of what she produces, the worker will always resist producing for the capitalist. The job of middle managers is to impose the will of the boss on the workers, to make sure the workers never think they have the right or the ability to control what happens in the workplace. The capitalist also needs middle-class financial, legal, scientific, design, and technical experts to find ways to increase profits. While ordinary workers are micromanaged, salaried professionals are encouraged to think creatively and act independently within the limits set by the boss. How professionals are trained to do this is explained later on. Middle-class managers, supervisors, foremen, overseers, and professionals can be distinguished from wage workers by the amount of control they exercise in the workplace. A unionized electrician on a construction site could be more educated, more skilled, and make more money than the site supervisor. However, the supervisor tells the electrician what to do. The supervisor has the power to schedule work, and some have the power to hire and fire. In turn, the supervisor is under the control of the big boss and keeps his job only as long as he carries out the boss's wishes. The gray zones. An indeterminate number of people inhabit the two gray zones on either edge of the middle class. The zone between the middle and ruling classes includes members of the ruling class who perform upper-level managerial functions and upper-level managers who are occasionally invited to make big decisions. This layer is of little interest in our discussion. There is a much larger gray zone between the middle and working classes. At one end are middle-class professionals whose degraded working conditions resemble industrial assembly lines. Physicians working for health management organizations, HMOs, are permitted to order only those tests and provide only those treatments that an employer approves. By removing their decision-making functions, HMOs force doctors into working-class conditions. In response, thousands of doctors have joined unions and organized collective bargaining units recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. At the other end of the zone, between the working and middle classes, are waged workers with small businesses on the side, like the bookkeeper with a weekend gig in a dance band. People in the gray zone may alternate between working for others and working for themselves. Consider the restaurant worker with a small catering business on the side. If her business does well, she may hire an apprentice and move into the middle class. If she drops her business to work full-time at the restaurant, she moves back into the working class. The prostitute who works for herself is middle class. The one who works for a pimp is working class. When it is difficult to decide if someone is middle or working class, that person is most likely in the gray zone. Blended class families are formed when middle and working class people marry. A doctor marries a secretary, a musician marries a truck driver, a minister marries a miner. Changes of fortune also create blended class families. The disbarred lawyer takes a job at the post office, and the steelworker's daughter goes to medical school. The gray zone also includes workers who perform managerial functions. These include salaried social workers, nurses, grade school teachers, prison guards, and active duty soldiers. All are working class because they have little or no control over their own working conditions. At the same time, their jobs give them some control over others. Chapter 12 described how social workers can support or destroy the lives of people who have even less power. Teachers have power over their students, grooming some for success and abandoning others to failure. Nevertheless, most teachers are working class. They are restricted to an established curriculum, and like their students, their days are regimented to the sound of the bell. In contrast, middle-class university professors generally have more freedom to choose what they teach and how they teach it. Professors also exercise power over other workers, in particular, graduate student teaching assistants. Grade school teachers have no authority over other school employees. Ordinarily, soldiers are working class because they have absolutely no control over the conditions of their work. At the same time, the active duty soldier has a middle class function, to control others. Soldiers are not in the same class as police officers. The working class soldier is drilled to follow commands without thinking, while the police officer is a middle class professional who is trusted by the higher-ups to know who to target, who to charge, who can be roughed up, and whose life has less value. When workers who perform managerial functions rebel, they can really rattle the system. Under normal conditions, teachers indoctrinate their students with the values of capitalism. When teachers press for higher wages and better working conditions, they become role models for rebellion. The same holds true for social workers who demand more funds for social services. Soldiers who switch sides can stop wars and topple ruling classes. In 1917, Russian soldiers joined with other workers to pull Russia out of the First World War. A few months later, German sailors sparked a revolution that forced the Kaiser to abdicate and effectively ended the war. In the 1960s, rebelling U.S. soldiers in Vietnam dealt a serious blow to the American Empire. I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours if you send them to me. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link at the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where you can also find MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes of the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.